find at the top of the staircase. It says, "There above it stood the Lord, and he said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring.'" Does that sound familiar? He says, I'm the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. Abraham, of course, was his grandfather. They use that term father to refer to any descendant. But this reminds us a lot of God's words to Jacob's grandfather, right? Abraham. He said to Abraham, God said back in chapter 22, "I'll surely bless you, make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed." Also reminds us of what God said to Jacob's father, Isaac. He said, "To you and your descendants, I will give all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father, Abraham. I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. Through your offspring, all the nations on earth will be blessed." And so because of this repetition, there's no doubt that the promise is moving from Abraham to Isaac and now to Jacob and no one else, not Esau, right? But while there's much repetition in these promises, there are also some differences worth noting. For example, God told Abraham and Isaac that their descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sands on the seashore. But to Jacob, God skips any mention of the stars and he changes grains of sand to dust of the earth, which certainly amplifies the promise. In fact, the language used here is that of conquest, of spreading out, just like dust spreads out and covers the whole earth. That's what God's going to do. And you think again of this promise that is included in every one of these covenants. All nations on earth will be blessed. You and I are blessed because of Jacob. If you are a believer in Jesus Christ, don't dismiss this. You're blessed because of Jacob. He had a crucial role to play in your salvation. God used him. We are blessed in part because of this guy that, if we're honest, many of us have been tempted to despise. Have we not? Anybody? Anybody want to admit it? Have we been tempted to despise Jacob? Pretty dirty, low-down guy. But God did not despise Jacob. No, in fact, the promise gets even better. Look at verse 15. "I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." In Jacob's time and thereafter, there was this impression that people had that gods were geographically confined. Did you know that? So if you go into a new area, let's say you're traveling and you're from Assyria and you go to Egypt, you better figure out pretty quickly when you get there what you need to do to appease their gods. Because guess what? You didn't bring the Assyrian gods with you. They had to stop at the border. Okay, so there was that idea. So here's Jacob leaving his country, leaving everything behind, and leaving behind, in his mind, probably the God of his fathers. There's a story in 1 Kings 20 about a war between the Arameans and the Israelites, and Israel was getting the best of Aram. So the king of Aram consulted his advisors to see how they could reverse their fortunes here, and they advised him, "Their gods are gods of the hills. That is why they were too strong for us. But if we fight them on the plains, we will surely be stronger than they." So we need to get the Israelites out of the hills into the plains, and then we can beat them. And the king thought, great idea. Let's get them onto our turf, because their God has to stop at the border. And the living God must have laughed. It's likely that Jacob, being a product of his culture, held on to this notion of geographical limitations for God. And we sometimes do that too, don't we? Do you ever think that you are nearer to God because of your physical location. You ever think that? It's embarrassing story Sunday. I'm going to give you one. Okay, when I was probably a sophomore in college, I broke into a locked church building. And it wasn't to steal anything or vandalize anything, okay? It was actually to get closer to God. And I'm sure the police would have been happy to accept that explanation. My neighbor, the pastor of that church, was dying of cancer. And I felt like my prayers were not being heard. I felt like there was a distance between me and God. So I had to close the distance, right? So where did I go? I went to his house. And he locked it. And so I had to break in. Well, I was no nearer to God. That's why I don't use that expression. I actually think when we say, welcome to the house of God, I think it's kind of misleading. It's not. This is a great place because you get to be with the people of God. You're always with God, the true God, maker and owner of every piece of land on the whole earth, said to Jacob, wherever you go, I'm going to be there with you. I'll never leave you. And this is key. I'm going to get you back home. King David understood this. He wrote in Psalm 139, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Rhetorical questions. If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If the promise of God's presence was a source of great comfort to Jacob, and I assume it must have been, don't we have the same promise? Didn't God say to the Israelites in Deuteronomy, don't be afraid, I will never leave you nor forsake you? And we say, well, he said that to the Israelites. But then didn't the New Testament writer of Hebrews take that very quote and repeat the promise and apply it to Christians, saying, look, don't put your hope in money. Don't go chasing money as if it's going to give you some security. For God himself has promised, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. An omnipresent God is our security wherever we go. Don't we have that promise? And didn't Jesus remind his disciples in the Great Commission, Matthew 28, surely I am with you always to the very end of the age? So if Jacob took comfort in that promise, wait, think about it. Why did God give him the promise? Does God waste words? Does he just talk? No. He gave him the promise because he knew he needed it. He told Jacob that because he knew he needed it. And he tells us that because he knows we need it. To know that he is with us. Despite whatever trial you're going through, God is near. And that's not one of those cliches that we just say. It's biblical truth. Whatever you are going through, if you are a believer in Christ, God is near. He is with you. Wandering around, feeling lost, feeling aimless, he's with you. You need to remind yourself of that truth, that God is never geographically confined. You don't go off and find him. He finds you, and he will get you home. Verse 16. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And obviously, it wasn't the house of God, and it wasn't really the gate of heaven. So I don't think Jacob completely understands now, but he's starting to catch on. And I think the idea is that God has his attention. If you think about Jacob up to this point, there is absolutely nothing in Jacob's life from when he first appeared in chapter 25 until now. There's nothing there that shows us that he has any regard whatsoever for the living God. The only time he even mentions God's name, remember, Pastor Phil pointed this out, the only time Jacob even mentioned God's name is when he took it in vain, right? Because his father said, wow, you're back fast. How'd you get that game and kill it? When he thought he was Esau, and he says, oh, the Lord your God has given me success. So Jacob, actually, the only time we see him even mentioning God, he's invoking God into his deception. That's how little he thinks of the living God. By all indications, Jacob was a worldly man, but now he has been given a glimpse of heaven, and it has an effect on him. He's not there yet. He's going to continue to make mistakes, but he is clearly on a journey. And we can learn from this. We learn that God is not merely interested in Jacob as someone to help fill out the messianic branch of the Abraham's family tree. That's not it. God loves Jacob. God is interested in Jacob. God is interested in his spiritual well-being. Verse 18, continuing. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. Bethel means house of God. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. And some people look at this and they call attention to Jacob's, the use of the word if here in verse 20. And they say, see, look, Jacob's agreement is conditional. God, if you're going to do this, you're going to lead me around, be with me, give me food and clothing, then I will, respond. They say, how unspiritual. They'll say, lack of faith. You know, he's saying, if God, he should have been saying when. Well, not so fast. I don't know that we can get that from the text. Now, if I say to Jerry, Jerry, I'm going to the Ohio State Michigan game, and I want you to come with me. Here's a ticket. And he takes it and he puts it in his pocket. And he says, hey, if you're going to do that, at least let me buy you dinner. You see, does that mean he doesn't, because he said if, he doesn't believe it? I think we're too hard on Jacob sometime. I don't know what has changed in me. I couldn't stand this guy. But it's like now I'm starting to think, golly, I see a little bit of myself in Jacob, and I kind of want to defend him a little bit. I don't know that this is so bad, what he's saying. I think he's taken great strides in a pretty short amount of time. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, it wasn't long ago when he couldn't do anything right. And I think sometimes we need to be easier on some of these Bible characters. We can be pretty tough on them. And that's easy because we have 2,000 years of safe distance, right? And they're just easy targets. I'm not so sure that I would have done any better. And so I think we need to be careful. But before moving on, I want to make a quick observation about verse 20 here. Some might use a verse like this to suggest that the tithe, because it transcends the law of Moses, right, that it's now in place still. It's still binding because, yes, Jesus fulfilled the law, right, but the tithe was before the law. That's what people sometimes say. And so it's still binding. Well, not necessarily. I think we could come up with some exceptions to that rule. But I also think that folks are missing what's going on in verse 20 here. And I have seen this, by the way. I've seen people try to use this to say that the tithe is still in place. This was a voluntary tithe, right? This was not a mandated tithe. This was a voluntary tithe. So I'm going to go halfway. I'm going to meet my brother. I'm going to go halfway and say that I think we should mandate a voluntary tithe. How's that? Is that good? Is that a good compromise? Mandate a voluntary. Did you get it? You don't have to do it. the Bible does not say that Christians have to tithe. I know we've been over this before. What does the New Testament say? It says that we should give. It says we should give joyfully. It says we should give generously. And so you should give. But there's no rule. In fact, the rule, I think, would probably cause some of us to give for the wrong reasons. I think it would be letting some of us maybe off the hook. I hope you will be generous. But you sort out what that means. You go to God. You ask God. We're going to jump into chapter 29 here and cover the first part of this story. I'm not going to have a lot to say about this. This is actually mostly just a setup for next week. Chapter 29, verse 1. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away. Shepherds, notice, plural. They'd roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter, Rachel, with the sheep." Rachel, by the name, her name means ewe, like a female sheep, which seems fitting for a shepherdess, right? Wait till you find out what her sister's name means. I'll leave you in suspense. Okay. Verse 7. "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It's not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and then take them back to the pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." In other words, we've got to get them all in first. While he was still talking to them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Okay, so this was a big stone. Normally it took several people, but Jacob's like, "I'll get the stone," right? We know that Rachel was attractive. We find that out elsewhere, right? So Jacob is typical guy, right? He's showing off. It says, verse 11, "Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud." And young men, let me give you a tip, okay? I know this worked for Jacob. Different culture. When you see a girl you're interested in, this is not the way to go about it, okay? Just play it cool, all right? Verse 12. "He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, 'You are my own flesh and blood.'" Jacob didn't know this yet, but this was his landing spot. He is going to spend the next 20 years of his life right here in this place with these people. And he's going to experience both fortune and misfortune. And God will keep his promise to Jacob to be with him in that land. What do we learn from Jacob's journey here? I think one of the lessons we take away is about grace. The thing that we were singing about this morning. Was Jacob searching? Was he seeking God? Was he looking for him? What was Jacob doing? He was running. He wasn't searching. He was running. Because people generally aren't searching for God. Sometimes grace takes people by surprise. And it took Jacob by surprise. We see that from his reaction. So he wasn't searching. Was Jacob deserving? Not at all. Not at all. In our human arrogance, we sometimes think that we are making ourselves fit for God's kindness, making ourselves fit for God's grace. I'm going to do this and this and this, And that is a total misunderstanding of grace. Because grace, by definition, is unearned favor. Think of the Pharisees. They did not receive grace. Look at all they did. They tithed on their little spices. Put aside 10%. Because God wants that. Oh, look at how conscientious we are. We'll go above and beyond the law. We'll decorate the tombs of the prophets. Everyone will know how spiritual and wonderful we are. We'll wear long, flowing robes to show how spiritual we are. And we'll take the seats of honor because we deserve them. We're God's MVPs. God is lucky to have us. But they didn't have God. Jesus was clear on that. God rejected them on account of their arrogance and on account of their blindness. He rejected them. But here's Jacob. What a scoundrel. What a cheat. He tricked Esau out of his birthright. He stole his blessing. He flat out lied to his father's face. I mean, if you picture that scene where Isaac's sitting there and he's, you know, rubbing his arms and, oh, it sounds like it's the voice of Jacob, but it's, you know, it feels like and smells like Esau. Yeah, it's me, Dad. This guy is a jerk. Jacob. And now he's on the run like the wretch that he is. And God says, I choose you. Does God's choice remind you just a little bit of those Galilean fishermen that Jesus looked at and said, follow me? Later reminded them, you didn't choose me, I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit that will last. Does Jacob remind you of Peter, the denier, and John, the cowardly forsaker? Does he remind you of Thomas, the doubter, or Matthew, the swindling tax collector? Does God's choice remind you of Paul a little bit, the guy who persecuted Christians? Does God's choice remind you of the guy sitting in front of you right now, or the lady to your left? Or the person you looked at in the mirror this morning? One thing I think I'm learning about God is that He is so much more generous and gracious than man. You know, if somebody will simply humble himself before God, I'm a sinner. I'm a wretch. I need you. If somebody will simply humble himself before God, God will keep the promise that He makes over and over in the Scriptures, right? Humble yourself, and I'll lift you up. I will raise you up. And that's something that the guy that was sleeping on the rock pillow, that's something he had going for him. Yes, he was a jerk. He was a scoundrel. But he seemed to know it. And God can work with that. What about us? God can work with us. Jesus, our ziggurat, has made that possible. He has bridged the gap between heaven and earth so God can work with us. Wherever you are, humble yourself before Him, and He will lift you up.